good morning. All right. I need everybody to scream as loud as they can right now. Just say, good morning.
Good morning.
All right. That's good. The first group, they were kind of lame. I am pleased to introduce Ross Turk, who's been with SourceForge for 10 years now. And he said this is his ninth position at SourceForge. And he couldn't really explain to me what he does, so I'm going to let him try to explain to you what he does.
It's in the deck. That's the cool part. It's in the deck.
So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Ross and let him do his thing.
Hello. How's everybody doing today?
Good.
Yeah? Cool? Good. Well, so this is Open Source Business for Hackers. That's the title of the top of the conversation. And I wanted to sort of frame it a little bit. I'm not a business guy. I'm not like a business jerk that they send out in the world to shill for SourceForge. I have an engineering background. My title right now is a matter of some confusion. I've been at the company for 9 years. We've had 5 company names, we've had 3 CEOs, and now we have a whole new set of organizations. But I started off at SourceForge as a web developer back in the day, and then I did some services architecture and things like that. Then I was the site architect for SourceForge, and then the engineering manager for SourceForge. Then they decided that I was so good at tap dancing, they wanted to make me the community manager. Then I got director of community, and now my title is like director of Forge or something. We're still trying to figure it out. But the real thing that I do is I'm kind of the double agent for the community. My job is to listen to the people who run my company, SourceForge Incorporated, to listen to the developers that use our services, to listen to the consumers that use the software that our developers create, to listen to the open source community at large, and to a limited extent, to listen to the advertisers who pay our bills, because unfortunately, we have to, we have to pay for everything, and to try to get everybody to sort of not hate each other quite so much, and maybe even kind of like each other. That's my job. I'm kind of like the lightning rod of hate for SourceForge, and I'm the one that they send out to talk to all of you. So, a good question about open source business is, why should I care, right? If I'm an open source developer, what does business mean to me? And the first thing is money, right? Who hates money? Anybody hate money? No. No, we like money. We like money. It's not all we do, but we like money. And the truth is that you can actually build good businesses that generate a decent amount of revenue if you have enough capital to get started, right? If you have a complicated and interesting enough problem and a crowd of people, ideally frightened and excited people, who are interested in what you're doing, right? So these things are, I'm going to go into more detail about all of those things in the future, but first thing to sort of frame it is it doesn't have to be about greed, right? So when we talk about building businesses around open source, it doesn't necessarily have to be about becoming the next Microsoft and making money hand over fist and being wonderful to people. Money is good for things besides keeping for yourself and hoarding. For example, if you run an open source project, you can use money to pay for equipment, right? If you're a project like Audacity, you can pay for audio equipment to help you test your project and make it better. You can pay for travel to come to conferences like this, or OSCON, or Feastly in Brazil, which is really great. You should try it. I mean, if you think people are freaky about free software here, go there. They're lighting bonfires in the exhibit hall. It's crazy. Conference passes, another thing that money can buy that requires funds. Hosting, Amazon, Linode. Maybe you could host at SourceForge too, but hosting costs money. Stickers and stuff to give your community to make them excited, and T-shirts. All these things require money. Pizza, beer. Devs need beer. But the point I'm trying to make is that if you're not interested in making money, someone in your community might be interested in making money from the projects you create, and they might be interested in using the software you build to pay for some of these things. I will stop and pause and drink some Mountain Dew because I have like 150 slides to get through. yeah, absolutely. Now, first, before we go any further, there's a couple of exercises we should all do to figure out where we sit on a bunch of different levels, ideological levels and belief systems. Because when you're thinking about crossing open source and capitalism, you better know where you stand. The first question you should ask yourself and your community is, should software be free, right? There are a lot of different answers to this. The first is, yes, right? Always. No exceptions for any reason. How many people feel that way? Okay. Very, very proud. The next answer could be, yes, you know, whenever practical, right? Whenever it makes sense, whenever it's logical. The third is, yeah, unless there's a way to make worthwhile money restricting the freedom of software, right? Believe it or not, some people feel that way. You know, I don't. Maybe only if it can be useful to someone else, right? How many people feel like software should be free if it's useful? You know, if that software is useful to someone else? Or, you know, I mean, some of the other folks might feel like, no, why would you want to do that? Software can be sold. Why would you make it free, right? But it's important to understand where you fit along this continuum. I personally am somewhere between, I'd like to say I was A, but I'm probably more like B or D, right? Because, you know, it depends on what you're doing. But I wish I were A. A lot of people should be A. The next question you should ask yourself is, how would we feel if someone else profits from our work as a community? You know, how would that make us feel knowing that someone else out there is making money off of the work we've done? Some of us feel like, cool, you know, whatever. So if you're writing an open source project and someone's making money, how do you feel about it? Do you feel kind of whatever about it? Or do you feel, no? How about fine as long as we get credit? You know, there we go. How about fine as long as they contribute? You know, contribute back to the community, a few, all right? How about, yeah, you know, they can sell deployment or training, but I don't want them to sell the actual software itself. You know, that's also reasonable. And then maybe just no, straight up no, I don't want that. The third question everybody should ask is, why are we building open source? It's important to know how you feel about that, because it's the best way to solve the problem we're trying to solve, perhaps. Maybe because someone told us to, our boss, or our teacher if you're a student, or your mom, or whoever told you, you should build open source, and then you built it. I mean, a lot of us build it because our boss tells us to build it. I mean, a lot of people that we pay build open source because our boss tells us to. Maybe because you want to start a business, right? You want to start an actual business. A lot of people get into open source to start businesses. Maybe because you find it fun and stimulating. You know, how many of us are in it for that, right? A lot of us, right? Or because the world needs more free software. So I think that as I go through the rest of this content, let's frame it all in the context of those questions so that we know kind of where we stand on issues, because a lot of the things I'm going to suggest or the things I'm going to talk about only make sense to communities depending on how they answer these questions. So the next part is ways to make money. I can't think of, I had to take a picture of this. This is the saddest sign ever, right? Like open for business, it looks all wonky and trashy. But what I want to first talk about is the multiple different types of business models that you can have in open source, and get their models and they're doing business, just in case you didn't get the joke. Boo. All right, so what is a business model? Business model is, I buy X from this person and I add my value on top of it, and then I sell it to the customer and I deal with my competition and all of that. You know, it's the mechanics by which a business is run and makes its money and how you add value to society that's worth enough that someone's willing to pay you for it, right? That's a business model. The first business model for open source, and the one that a lot of open source companies tend to want to go to, is the open source, closed source hybrid, which is now, there's a euphemism now, open core, which I think is kind of meh, you know. That's how they keep from saying that it's proprietary, because they call it open core. And what this is you have your core functionality, which is usually called a community edition, and that's what is free, that's what everybody gets for free, and it's open source. And then the company will add things like backup and restore, or full text search, or email integration, you know, or, you know, whatever. And they call that a professional edition, and that costs you money, and you pay for it. Then they'll add like mobile support and, you know, reporting and workflow and management console and clustering or whatever and co-branding, and then they call that their enterprise edition, and that costs a lot more money, right? So pitfalls. Can anybody guess some of the pitfalls of this particular business model for open source? No? Well, yeah, absolutely. You're constantly in battle with the innovation of a community, right? You have to stay one step ahead of the community if you're the company. Tends to work for projects that have a lot of, like companies that have a lot of funding to build a product, but not a community of developers who want to help them build it necessarily. I think one of the main pitfalls is that you have to have core functionality that's so good that people want to pay for more. You know, like that people want to, that people say, hey, I need that. That I need more than that. That's fantastic. And the second pitfall for me is it can be seen as a bit evil in some circles, right? Depending on how you answered those questions, having an open core with proprietary extensions might seem a little bit manipulative, depending on who you're selling to. Actually, I had a list of what it depends on. Depends on who you are, what you care about, right? Who's developing for you, who you're serving, and who you choose to sell to, right? So this has got some major pitfalls, this one. The next pitfall is, you know, you have to worry a lot about licensing, right? If you're using, like for example, GPL or something like that, make a proprietary version on top, it's kind of wacky. You have to worry about whether you can actually give away and sell at the same time. But there are a lot of companies that do this, you know? Sugar, you know, Zimbra, MindTouch, Zenos, Hyperion, Pentaho, they all have this business model. The next business model I think is interesting is services and support. So in this business model, you have the same open source project potentially, but you're selling services on top, services like, you know, customization, installation, training. Then you sell support contracts where you have hosting, for example, you know, like a SaaS model, priority patches. I know there are a lot of companies who say, when we find a bug, we'll give patch to you first if you pay us money. Troubleshooting, you know, quicker troubleshooting and indemnity, which is kind of interesting. It's saying, if you ever get sued as a result of using our stuff, then we'll cover you, right? Pitfall? Anybody can think of a pitfall of this model? Yeah, exactly. But of the entire services support business model, I think that one challenge is that other people can do the exact same thing you're doing. Right. If you're selling services and support on your product, then other people can sell services and support on your product too. So you have to do it better than anybody else. Maybe you have a certified service provider program, something like that. You know, the pitfall too is that I think this has a less chance of being seen as evil. But on a strict economic basis, the margins are a bit slimmer, right? Because let's say you're building software. If you're Microsoft and you spend 3 years building an operating system or 10 or 20, right? Yeah, well, you know, I mean, if you spend a certain amount of time building an operating system, you sell it forever, right? And every time you sell it, the incremental cost is pretty close to zero. If you're selling services, I sell 10 hours of my time. Every hour I deliver, I have to invest an hour of time. So it's the margins are slimmer. And when I presented this before and someone said, you know, really got on about how the services business model is great, and I think it is. But purely economically speaking, it's not. It's a little tougher of a business because it's, you know, but a lot of companies still do it, you know, a lot of very, you know, recognizable companies. Now, you can do a combination of these business models. For example, who's heard of Concrete 5? Anybody heard of Concrete 5? No? Wow, okay, one. Well, you should look at this. It's a really cool CMS. These guys have a pretty unique approach towards making money with open source. They have the standard project, which is on SourceForge, right? And it's under the MIT license. But they also offer a services business model where they have consulting, support, installation. They know their project better than anybody else. On top of that, they also have hosting. And when you go to their site, you see a button, host with us or host your own, right? If you click host your own, right to the SourceForge page, not very helpful. If you click host with us, it gives you, you know, this excellent service experience where you get your thing. They also have a marketplace of plugins. As a CMS, that you can buy a block for a flash gallery or for a, you know, animated whatever, or a shiny this or whatever. And it's like $15 to get this, you know? And so I'm kind of pulling for them because I want to see this model go forward. There's a lot of plugins that are free, but there's a lot that you pay for. And even more than that, they allow other developers to make plugins as well and sell them through their marketplace, which is kind of creative and interesting. The other business model that's worth mentioning is dual licensing. Everybody familiar with dual licensing? Okay, well, for those who aren't, let's say I'm AwesomeSoft and I make this thing called the Pecuniatrix, and other Latin speakers know what that means. And it's Pecuniatrix 1.0, and I'm selling it for big, mad stacks of cash, right? But one of my developers has included CommunoDB 5.2 in it, right? Which could be problematic because I'm proprietary, but CommunoDB is GPL. So I can approach the CommunoDB people and say, you know what, GPL not really working for me because I can't you know, integrate the way I want to with my product. So we sign a contract that says what I can do with it, and I give them a big pile of money, and instead of, you know, GPL, now they say, congratulations, this is a BSD licensed product. Yay. Right? Magic. Right? So One pitfall of this is that you are building a business based on preventing people from doing what they want to do. So you're fighting against nature. You're saying, my business depends on fighting the human nature of people to do what they feel like doing, which is use my software the way they want to use it. So it's enforcement. Another pitfall is, when you think about it, you're not really selling anything, right? You're selling magic. You're selling a contract. You're a bunch of people standing around a table signing a contract, and that's where your money comes from. It's kind of weird, like you're not actually selling anything. So I've differentiated all these business models from what I consider fundraising. And I was looking at these slides last night, and I realized there's not really that much of a difference. You know, I don't know why I made the distinction, but I did. Maybe it makes sense to you. The first of which is merchandising. I mentioned Audacity earlier. They have a store. You can go to their store and buy their shirts and buy their stickers and hats and things like that, which is cool. But you can also buy audio interfaces, which is very topical to what they do. They're a multi-track audio editor. You can buy an audio interface that works great with Audacity. I'm sure they get a cut. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're nice. They're doing it because they're nice. But I bet they get a cut. It's pretty successful, I think. The Mozilla store, right? Who has bought something from the Mozilla store? A couple people? Enough? Okay, well, if two of you did, then millions of people did, right? So I'm sure it works out fine for them. You know, Debian has a store, that sort of thing. Merchandising also includes book sales, right? You know, if you know your project, you write a book, I've been told it is a spectacular business. Lots of money. Not really. But anyway, it's worth mentioning. Pitfall of merchandising is logistics, right? Manufacturing and shipping. If you're a coder and you're a hacker, do you really want to be boxing stuff up or dealing with distributors? Probably not. Another advertising model, which I'm very close to, it's near and dear to my heart, is advertising. And I hate advertising, which is kind of ironic because I work for SourceForge. But who can see the ads on this page, right? Are they intrusive? Everyone knows where they are. Yeah, they're kind of right there, you know? This page, kind of the same thing. It's another SourceForge project, MediaCoder. They have advertising. And then, of course, the most successful open source project for advertising, because it doesn't look like an ad, right? Millions of dollars, crazy money. There's two basic ways you calculate advertising. On a cost per impression basis, CPM. It's a basic formula, right? If N, bad contrast. Looked great on the screen. If N is your number of pages, right? CPM is your cost per 1,000 impressions. It's really simple. N divided by 1,000 times CPM equals dollars, right? So if I have 1 million impressions on my site and divide by 1,000 times the $3 CPM, which is not intergalactic in proportions. It's okay. It's pretty good, actually. You get 3,000 bucks. 1,000 page views, 3,000 bucks. Pretty good. Cost per click is a little more important. This is the other way of looking at advertising. If N is your number of pages and CTR is your percentage of people who click on ads, then DPC, which I've totally made up, is totally not an industry standard thing. DPC is your dollars per click. Then N times CTR times DPC equals your dollars. So a million hits times a, you know, 3% click-through rate, which is pretty good. What's that? 0.3%. Yes, thank you very much. 0.3% times like a dollar CPM is 3,000 bucks, right? I fudged it so it all comes out to be the same, right? But you get the idea. So $3,000 for a million impressions is an effective CPM of $3, so it's kind of the same. That's a lot of detail for ads that probably everybody could figure out. Like, so AdSense uses this model. Google's AdSense uses this model. Standard traditional advertising uses the other model, usually. There's also cost per acquisition, cost per lead, cost per conversion. There's a bunch of others, but these are the main ones. What's the pitfall of this particular business model? Is there one? Well, yeah, you have to have a lot of traffic, like a ton of traffic. Like, for example, I said a million hits is $3,000. So this is how many hits the top projects on SourceForge get on their websites every week. So Emule is getting 5 million hits. That's, you know, money. That's good money. But you go down the list, and you suddenly start to lose that opportunity, right? The second thing is, and I know this, your users might find it really irritating, right? You know, they might not like advertising. They might think it's not a good thing. The other thing is, you have this arms race with your scammers. For example, Audacity, the project. We sell ads on all of our projects' pages because that's how we get paid. And you know, but anyway, someone keeps buying the ads from Google for Audacity. And then they keep sending those users to a site that charges them money to send them Audacity, Like, they send them right back to the SourceForge download page. Congratulations, I've just sold you this audio editing software. Here's SourceForge, go download it, right? And so they contact us, and we block the advertiser on our Google account, and then, you know, they change their domain name, and they change their company name, and they try it all over again. So there's this arms race. It's kind of like the spam arms race. Another way of doing fundraising is the donations, grants, and memberships approach, right? Or the foundation approach. You can also use the SourceForge donation system if you're hosted on SourceForge. We do a lot of donation clearing there. A lot of people use this. You know, Apache, Linux Foundation, Eclipse, you know, the Eclipse Foundation. You know, a ton of people do this. But the pitfall is you need to be able to cope with money, right? And that's actually the pitfall for all of these, is that if you're going to accept money as an open source project, you need to have a way to cope with it. You need to have good accounting practices. You need to have agreement amongst your community about how the money gets spent, yada, 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 yada. So on to the next major section. I know I'm just like going straight through. If anybody wants to stop me and ask a question, just like wave your hands or whatever. But the next thing I want to talk about is businessy things that also kind of in an uncanny way apply to open source. So being someone who has been in the community and then has been thrown into this shark's pit of business people, I'm noticing there's some similarities that I wanted to call to your attention. The first thing is the sales funnel. Is anybody familiar with this concept of the sales funnel? Yeah, some? So for those who aren't, this is the sales funnel. If that bar represents the people who might someday want to buy your stuff, then that bar represents people who are willing to talk to you, right? If those people are willing to talk to you, then these people need something that maybe you can provide, like there's a good fit, you know? These people, you still think you can help after you continue talking to them, right? These people want to buy it. These people can agree with you on the price, and these people will actually send you a check, right? Very small. And how salespeople work is they look very scientific. It's not tap dancing at all. Very scientific and meticulous. They look at how they can grease the sides of the funnel and reduce the barriers on the way down, you know? There's a similar funnel in open source that you can deal with in a similar way, and it's what I call the open source funnel. If these people are looking for a solution to their problem, right? Then these people can find your project. They can actually find it, you know? If they find it, then these people choose to actually download it. Like they look around on your website and they can figure out how to download it, and then they actually download your project, and these can figure out how to install it. These people can actually use it. They actually open it. These people will participate in your community in very small ways. They'll tell you when it's broken, or they'll tell you that it works. They'll talk on the mailing lists. These people will generate new peripheral value to your project. You know, they'll write a how-to, or you know, submit an idea, or build a plugin or an extension. These people will take the time to understand how your product works on the inside. These people will submit patches, and these people will become a committer, right? So it's a similar funnel. What makes it similar is that you use the same kind of approach to reducing the barriers, and you also have to understand in both how wide the top of your funnel is. For example, if you are OpenOffice, you got a pretty wide funnel. Most people need an Office suite, most. If you're Azurus and you are a peer-to-peer client that helps people download stuff, you know, pretty wide. Everybody wants free stuff. Everybody wants media. Everybody wants a BitTorrent client. If you're Gallery, a lot of people take photos. Most people want to share them, you know. Audacity, you know, if you manage a MySQL database, maybe it's a little more narrow. You know, if you manage a data center, your funnel's a little more narrow. If you're a developer, maybe a little more narrow. And if you're my dumb project that I started 10 years ago and have never touched, then my funnel is not very wide at all, you know? So there's kind of a graph of impact versus audience size. For example, Firefox has a very wide audience and a very large impact. Everybody needs it, and it's a big part of their life, right? So they have bigger problems when they figure out how to manage their funnel. They have to be more sophisticated about it. Something like Nagios, right? Huge impact if you run a data center. It's very important. It ruins your life. But not many people run data centers. So it's important to understand that. Talking a bit more about barriers, the important thing to think about is how at each level of that funnel can you reduce the barriers? First thing, is your project easy to find? If I type open source audio editor, are you the first? Basic SEO, you know? Can you find the project that will fit their needs? Second is it easy to download, right? I think that an interesting thing that we've figured out over the years. When you look at a heat map of our website, and a heat map is you put code on your website, some JavaScript, and it calls home, and it tells you where people are clicking in coordinates on your site. And most people click the download button. Most people, because they just want to get their stuff and leave. So Firefox made their download button gigantic, right? So you can't miss it. You know, that's what you're here for. Make it big. Because how many seconds who here looks at a web page for 3 seconds or less before they click on whatever occurs to them? Okay, that is everyone, for those of you who aren't looking. You got 3 seconds, right? Audacity takes a different tack because they actually are asking you to make a decision, right? But still, very clear what they want you to do. They want you to download. Next thing, is it easy to install? You know, this varies from platform to platform. But get yourself in an app repository, right? That's a way to reduce the barrier. Make it easy to install. Or if you're Mac, you know, use whatever convention makes sense for your operating system. The next barrier, how easy do you make it for people to get involved? This is a beautiful example. I spend about 180 days a year on the road. When this happens to me, I will say, yeah, I'll take the 3 seconds it takes to type in what I was doing and click submit. That's the extent of participation I'm willing to do because I don't have the time, right? Find ways for people to participate in 10 seconds, 5 seconds, an hour, a day, a month. Find ways for people to get involved in any way. This is brilliant. I love this model. I also love the model where people say, you know, did this work on your, hey, I noticed you're installing on, you know, freaking Irix. Did it work? Yes or no? Oh, wow, it worked. Great. I'll tell the developers. That's nice to know, right? The other thing is, you know, is your code clean? Does your code make sense? Is it easy to read? Is it easy to understand? So the science that salespeople use where they figure out what's going to keep people from progressing to the next stage of that funnel is the same science that you can use in the open source community to figure out how to get people to the bottom of your funnel. Anyway, next thing I wanted to talk about was branding. A lot of people don't know how branding applies to open source. Maybe I'll answer that question. Question, isn't branding for giant, powerful corporations? You know, like, why is it for us? You know, I mean, if you look at a lot of these companies that have very strong brands, and ask yourself, why do they have brands, right? I mean, what's the first thing that occurs to you? Why do these companies have brands? Recognition? Sure. So Wikipedia says, people engaged in branding seek to develop or align the expectations behind the brand experience, creating the impression that a brand associated with a product or service has certain qualities or characteristics that make it special or unique. So in other words, these people have brands so that people think their stuff is special and not run-of-the-mill and not different and unique. Example, regular generic sad soda, 55 cents. Yeah, 55 cents a liter, right? Coca-Cola, $1.42 a liter. So many people have their preferences. Oh, you know, generic Coke tastes like garbage. I like Coke better. Does it taste almost 2.5 times better? Yeah. Right? Does it? Really? No. But because they have put it's the same thing. But because they've put a value to their brand, you're willing to pay more. You're willing to pay more for their brand. It inspires confidence also. Here, I'm going to do a quick test. What's your first impression? Oil. Oh, that's interesting. So it didn't work on you. How many of you, look at this, I'm guilty. Guilty is charged. Maybe I'm just a schmuck, but I'm guilty. I look at this and I go, aw, that's so friendly. You know, I'm just like, aw, these people are nice people. And they look so green and so friendly and so sunshiny and planty. You know, that's what I think. The reality is very different, but that's what I think. Guilty, absolutely guilty. This was a quotation from someone who wrote a book about BP's branding. It said that they'd revamped their logo and appearance to improve its environmental image, and that their image was a major commercial and political asset. And like any asset, it has to be managed and looked after. So they see their brand as an asset. They see it as a way to manipulate the public. This is their original brand, BP, very shieldy and battle-y and big capital letters and we sell oil for your big American cars so you can destroy the world, you know? It's a little different from this, right? Which is, you were going to go hug some bunnies, right? Does it make you want to stop at a BP station when you're driving down the street, seeing this logo versus the other scary one? You know what I mean. So, Starbucks, one of the most egregious branders in the world, right? Their CEO was quoted as saying, "A great brand raises the bar. It adds a greater sense of purpose to the experience, whether it's the challenge to do your best in sports or fitness, or the affirmation that the cup of coffee you're drinking really matters." Right? So that's the power of the brand. Brand loyalty also is crazy, right? Like, I mean, kind of sad. I would feel it's very sad, but I have the Linux Penguin tattooed on my arm. But still, you know, brand loyalty. I am really strong. I feel very strongly about the brands that I like. I have brand loyalty, oddly enough, to two things, Linux and Apple. Oddly enough, I can't explain it. But anyway, the thought is, everything they make must be this good. You know, if I liked the latte and the, what are the other drinks? Whatever, the whatever espresso garbage they give you, right? Then when they come up with this new thing, this smoothie, it must be great. Well, it's not. So anyway, the brand is that powerful. So the question is, open source and branding, why, right? Why do we need open source branding? We don't need to convince people to spend more for our stuff. We don't need to tell people, you need to spend 0 × 10 for our software. You know, there's no multiple. We don't need to be seen as not being evil, because generally we're not, right? And there's not an addiction that we need to create for people, you know? I mean, we don't need them to keep coming back and coming back. Generally, we want them to choose the best solution. But yet, there's a lot of very powerful open source brands. Who knows this brand? Pigeon, of course. How about this one? That one. Yeah, okay. These get easier as it goes along, right? Linux, yeah, haha. Ubuntu. All right, so people in open source brand, why? Community, there you go, right? Team colors, community morale, right? To get people to you know, sort of collect around your brand. It's important to do. It's kind of the same thing that companies do. It gets people to feel strongly about what you're doing, to make you think, this isn't just software, this is something bigger than software, right? It also helps people know who you are, right? You know, it's people like visuals in addition to language. People like to have some way to visually identify you. Ultimately, it gets you more users too, because people expect to see this garbage, right? They expect a certain amount of polish around the things that they're being asked to use. Because ultimately, if your brand is well thought out and your presentation is well thought out, it suggests that your product and your software is well thought out. So that's kind of the purpose for that, at least from my perspective. Wow, I'm leaving a lot of time for questions. Maybe I shouldn't have had the Mountain Dew. And yet I take another sip. So, wow, current slide, 135 of 144. So, how y'all doing? I got some time? No, okay. Next session, spreading the word. In traditional promotion, you have public relations, and you have marketing agencies and campaigns, and you buy Super Bowl ads, and if you're Pixar, you fly a Zeppelin through Los Angeles. Anybody see that? I live in Los Angeles. It was crazy. They bought a Zeppelin for the movie Up, and I'm looking in the sky, and I'm like, oh, look, Up. Okay, I'll see it, right? Like, they bought a Zeppelin. So no open source project is buying a Zeppelin. There's still some things you can learn from traditional promotion that people do in the commercial world. The first thing is, you need to have a good story, right? You need to be able to express very quickly and very clearly what it is that you're trying to accomplish. First example, right? Azurus. When I have known them in the past, their story has been a little bit, you know, you're a BitTorrent client, you're a fairly heavy BitTorrent client. But no, find, download, and play high quality and high definition videos. Good story, right? Everybody likes free stuff. That's what they do. Whether their story matches to the software they built, it's up to you to evaluate, but the story is crisp, right? The story is clear. Gallery has a longer story, but they've taken they've done the nice thing of bolding the important stuff. Gallery photo album organizer, crisp. You don't need to read the rest, right? It's a photo album organizer for, you know, installing on your own website, integrating seamlessly. So the important thing is to have a crisp message. Another good piece of advice is to keep your ears open about what people are saying about you. So Google Alerts, very good tool for this. Twitter, good tool for this. I had a Twitter slide up here about someone who said something about some other open source project that was very poignant, but it's G-rated here, so I had to remove it. It was awesomely funny. I left it in. I'm going to skip it. Boom. All right. That's actually it. That's all I had on spreading the word. So we have some time for questions. So I'd like to open the floor for questions about open source business models, questions about open source branding, keeping in mind that I'm not a corporate shill, and SourceForge, if you want to talk about SourceForge, I'm here for that too.
All right, we're going to use a mic because we are recording these for later, so we want to get your questions. So who has questions? All right, let's start with you.
So you started off the talk talking about the different models that mm-hmm. people take.
Sure.
Where do you see the trends? So we've seen examples, but where do you see things?
Sadly, one of the trends I see is that companies are using open source as a marketing strategy, right? So take your typical software company. They have 10 engineers. Say you have a proprietary software company, 10 engineers, 5 salespeople, you're just getting started, right? I think that a lot of people are seeing open source as a way of generating leads, getting people to install their software and building their install base. So it's being seen, unfortunately, as marketing as opposed to community benefit. That's one kind of scary, concerning trend I see, that a lot of open source software companies are not truly open source. They don't accept contributions. You know, I asked a couple people who run moderately successful open source companies, so how much of your code is contributed from the community? And they said, we don't give anybody commit access. That's not what we do. So they have open source just so that they can say they're open source, get the credibility, get the PR benefit from it, and get an install base that's really wide, and then upsell people. So that's the sort of open core business model. Seeing a lot of that, and it kind of bothers me. I feel a little taken advantage of as someone who cares about open source. The other trend I'm seeing on services and support, I'm seeing people get a little bit more creative. You know, like Concrete 5, the example I had, they seem to be doing a smart thing because they have like 10 different business models, 10 different potential revenue sources, and they're seeing which one sticks. So I'm seeing a lot of experimentation. Not to say that the services business model doesn't work. I mean, look at IBM, you know, look at Red Hat, you know, they do it. But that's kind of what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a lot of experimentation. I'm seeing a lot of companies marginalize the importance of open source. Does that kind of answer your question? Yeah. Not entirely satisfying, I'm sure, but that's
Who's
what
next?
I'm seeing.
Anyone over here? Here, we'll start with you.
You know, what language and IDE do we want to program in? You write these softwares in.
Oh,
I mean, what's popular, though? I mean, I know C++, but what IDE is available right now that we can program in?
Well, it depends what you're building.
Open source software.
Open source web-based software, desktop software.
Desktop software.
Oh. Jeez, I don't know. Actually, I'll answer that with an anecdote. Our sales team comes to me and they say, we have a company. Very big company in the Pacific Northwest, sells an IDE. We want to know how to target people who are coming to SourceForge who are potentials for that IDE. So we need to find out what open source IDEs we're competing against. And I said, well, there's Eclipse, and then there's people who don't use IDEs. Right? You know, there's people who build their software in VI or Emacs, and they use Make or AutoConf or whatever it is that they're using, and they just build it the old-fashioned way because they don't want a tool telling them what to do. You know, as far as languages, Java is the biggest language on SourceForge now, but it's declining, right? Ruby's growing, Python with TurboGears is growing, especially because of the frameworks, right? Rails, Django, TurboGears, getting a lot bigger. Seeing a lot of interesting movement in databases as well, you know? Things like Mongo and Hadoop are taking places of traditional, you know, SQL databases. So that's kind of what I'm seeing. I'm not sure that that's exactly what you're asking for. But if I were learning to program today, I'm not sure I'd go with C++. You know, I'm a web guy, so I'm a little biased. But I would go with Python first, potentially PHP second. That's just me.
What kind of advice would you give to like a new open source project? What kind of ways could you make it more branding? What kind of models would you maybe suggest for a smaller, newer open source project or something like that.
Who's your audience? I think that the first thing is, understand your audience. You probably have given some thought to that. Understand your audience, get a good sense for your problem, right? Understand how to express it clearly. That's really the basics. You know, if you have a good understanding for who you want to use your software, then I think it becomes kind of obvious what the next steps are. Is your goal to be a business, or just to fund a little bit, or just to increase participation?
Most of the brainstorming now, probably just funding.
Funding, okay. I think that figuring out what your goals are, figuring out who your audience is, and what problem you're trying to solve is paramount. After that, it gets a little more complicated. Hi.
Hi there. I don't know, this might be a better question for Software Freedom Law Center or EFF, but I'll just ask you.
Sure.
You were talking
Maybe
about dual licensed projects. I've always kind of wondered whether there's kind of a GPL trip up there where projects that dual license under the GPL, if they accept a GPL contribution, wouldn't that restrain them from being able to dual license in that case?
Yeah, I think it depends on who owns the copyright for the code, right? Like, for example, company that doesn't have external contribution, the company owns the copyright for all the code. And they can release it under GPL or whatever license they want, and they can change their mind at any time. What's already been released under GPL will be released under GPL forever. Like when you come to SourceForge and you release your software as GPL, if you come back to us later and say, no, we're proprietary now, we want you to remove it, we'll give you the hand gesture and tell you, heck no, we're going to keep it. It's ours. It's the community's, you know? Like tough luck. However, if you have a lot of community contribution, a lot of open source projects require, before they give you committer access, that you sign a committer agreement that says all the copyright for this code belongs to the Eclipse Foundation or to, you know, like Awesome Corp or whoever owns it. If your project doesn't do that, then you're in a bit of a sticky situation, because then who owns the copyright to the code, right? Supposedly whoever wrote it. So I think that if you're a company and you want to engage in a dual licensing model, you have to solve the copyright problem first. And if you haven't solved that problem before you've gotten a lot of external contribution, you're in a situation. Does that kind of answer your question? Yeah.
Yep. So real quick, I'll comment on that, actually. It's not just the copyright, it's the right to use.
Okay.
That's the way Asterisk works, so I'm unfortunately very familiar with it.
Okay.
So my question was, if you've got an open source project and you start to take money for it,
yeah,
that creates kind of a big target on your forehead for people who are doing patent trolling. Would you say that that's a real issue these days yet, or is that something that if you start to take money, you can safely ignore for the time being, or is that a risk that you should consider when taking a business venture or taking an open source project and turning it into a commercial project?
I see what you're saying, because if you have no money, then no one's coming after you.
Bingo.
Yeah. Wow. What's that?
Scomite.
Yeah, Scomite. Yeah. Oh, boy. That is a good question. I'm not sure I have an answer for that. I think whether you should be concerned about it, the answer is yes. I don't think that patent storm has stopped. You know, there's been a couple of good victories, but I don't think it's over yet. I think you do have to be worried about it. And I think, actually, if you're going to start a business around open source that's of any substantial size, probably doesn't hurt to talk to a lawyer, you know, and just, you know, get a good sense for what your risks are.
As far as business models, I think actually depending on where you fit philosophically on that spectrum, mm-hmm. One way you could contribute with open source is to build a commercial product that's supporting the community of users of another open source thing. So,
okay.
For example, the question about editors. I know there's some commercial editors out there that are contributing very much into free and open source communities.
Mm-hmm.
So their contributions are contributions into the core of the languages that they're dealing with,
sure.
But they're still selling commercial products, and it's a commercially licensed product.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. If you can sell closed source software and still do good things for community, right? We don't SourceForge doesn't make open source software. We provide services for open source software. So that's another way to do it. Absolutely. There's another great example. Who's the Drupal company? Acquia, right? Another good example, right? I think that's entirely valid, absolutely.
Any more questions? This gentleman had his hand up first here.
I just wanted to make another observation or comment on the dual licensing. It's not just for commercial dual licensing. Like, I'm involved in the Eigen project, which falls under the KDE umbrella, and they've chosen a dual license of GPL or LGPL, and that sounds great on the surface, but it severely limits the other open source projects that can be brought into that fold, unless you can get the original copyright holder on board with the dual license.
Sure.
You're in for trouble. And it's great as long as everybody is sort of developing it under that project name, but it can be limiting in the long term.
Yeah, that's a good observation, right? I mean, license compatibility is a pretty complex thing. Dual licensing happens outside the scope of strictly piles of cash perspectives. That's a good observation.
Hi, I'm Beth Liniker of the Ohio Linux Fest.
Hi, Beth. Good to meet you.
Thanks, everybody. Actually, my question is for all of the audience. Who saw our ads on SourceForge? Anyway? All right, awesome. Did you know about us before then? Yes? Yes, that's 100% of the people who saw the ads on SourceForge but knew about us. Anyhow, did that cause you to decide to come today? The answer is no, that you already were sold on your decision to come today. Okay.
The advertising business is interesting.
Yeah. Oh, what can I say? We absolutely love SourceForge at the Ohio Linux Fest, and I was particularly interested in this talk because what we, as the Ohio Linux Fest project, continues to struggle with is the balance of branding and marketing to a level that will not basically make us look like a bunch of bizarre corporate freaks, because we're nonprofit, we're a 100% volunteer run organization. So maybe I should turn it back to a question for you, is how can a volunteer organization always look like a volunteer organization without looking like a bunch of corporate weirdos?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it, well, here's a question. How many of you think that Mozilla is a bunch of corporate weirdos? Okay. How many of you think that Mozilla has good marketing? Everyone, right? So what do they do that makes them good marketers without being horrible corporate jerks, right?
They're honest.
They say mistakes. Yeah, there we go. That's the first thing, right? Honesty. I'll take it a step further. Genuineness, right? I think that whenever someone sees a company that's egregious at branding, there's a lack of honesty. There's a lack of credibility. People go, okay, I see right through this. I see what they want me to do. You know, they're being a little sideways about it. You know, and I think that's garbage, right? So I think honesty is a big part of that. Having a message that is finely tuned, that is straightforward and honest, is good. We at SourceForge could learn a lot about that. You know, SourceForge is not just me. You know, I think I'm a pretty honest, straightforward guy. SourceForge is not just me. It's a lot of people. So honesty is a big part of that. I think also, understanding a target audience is a big part of that as well, right? If you are marketing to geeks in the, you know, northern Ohio or central Ohio or wherever, or the Midwest or anywhere like that, understand what kind of message they're going to like to hear, right? Advertising, this is something we learned at SourceForge. Advertising is not perceived as advertising if it's useful or informative or if it's targeted to you or if it's thoughtful, then it's not perceived as advertising, you know, then it's perceived as information. We get it right about 2% of the time with our advertisers, you know? So, did that answer your question, Beth? Beth
yes.
Is not paying attention. Thank you.
It answered your question.
All right.
All right, we've got time for one more question, so I'm going to pick this guy here in the middle. Because he's closer and I'm lazy.
Sure.
My question is if you have a business model, you have a project that you're doing, but you're selling to, is it worth educating the people who use your project slash product that it's open source? The project I have, I deal with charity auctions, and yeah. I've GPL'd all my code. So far, I'm the only one that has it, but those charities don't care.
Yeah.
Is it worth educating them on the, you know, why the project is good?
Well, I think it matters on why it's open source, right? If you believe that you're, if you're making open source because you believe software should be free and you think that that's something that's important, then yes, if you're an evangelist, evangelize to everybody you talk to, you know? If, so the other thing is, if your charities don't care if it's open source, that suggests to me that you're not going to get a credibility boost from doing so, right? For me, when I think about evangelizing open source in non-developer settings, it always feels a little like the NPR message to me. You know, this code was created by people like you, you know? Like, that's kind of what I get from it, you know? And I think that that keeping it at a high level is probably good if your audience doesn't care. You know, just say, by the way, this is open source, and I'm making this freely available to anybody else who does charity work. You know, find a way to relate it to them and say, you know, why would this software not be free? It'd be like the NAACP fighting with the UNCF for money, right? We're all working together, so I figured we'd let other charities use this software. What do you think? You know, that might be a cool way of making it less about open source and more about freedom of information, more about peer production and all of the underlying social movements to open source, as opposed to about the technology, right? Find a way to express the same spirit of peer production in a way that isn't technical.
All right, excellent. Let's give a big round of hands for round of applause for Ross Turk. And Ross, you're going to be running around here, so if people have questions, can they come and?
Absolutely. We'll clear out here because someone else is coming in, but I'll be right outside.
Excellent.